When you go to verse 18, it says, about the middle of the verse, I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river Euphrates. Notice these were normal rivers that were known to Abram. So this is a very literal tract of real estate. And then it says, to the Canaanite, the Kenizzite, the Cadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite, and the electric lights, and the out-of-sights, and the termites, and the mosquito bites, and all of these ites, those were the current possessors of the land that God was going to drive out and give to the nation of Israel. So, land, seed, and blessing, you see it all laid out there, and that becomes the basis of the sub-covenants. I call them sub-covenants because God later on entered into other covenants with the nation. And when you study these out, they all have the word berith or covenant in that language. But the land covenant is, land promises are developed in the land covenant, Deuteronomy 29 and 30. The seed promises are further developed in the Davidic covenant, given 1,000 years later during the time of David. The land covenant given about 600 years later after the time of Abraham in the time of Moses. And it's through David's line is going to come this king who's going to bring in an eternal dynasty. And then just prior to the Babylonian deportation, the new covenant is given. And there the blessing is amplified in terms of the laws of God are going to be one day placed in the hearts of the Jewish people. So they will have an inner compulsion to obey. Not just looking at tablets of stone and seeking to obey. That's called the New Covenant, Jeremiah 31:31-34. But that's a nice, neat outline of the covenant structure, but the basis of the whole thing is the Abrahamic covenant. The rest of the Bible is building on this Abrahamic covenant. John Walvoord says this of the covenant with David. The covenant with David is not only given twice in its major content, namely 2 Samuel 7, and 1 Chronicles 17, but it is also confirmed in Psalm 89. In this and other Old Testament references, there is no allusion anywhere to the idea that these promises are to be understood in a spiritualized sense as referring to the church or to a reign of God in heaven. Rather, it is linked to the earth and to the seed of Israel and to the land. There is no indication that this kingdom extended to a spiritual entity such as the church, nor that the throne in view is the throne of God in heaven rather than the throne of David on the earth. Such a situation does not prevail in this present age and is not related here or elsewhere to the reign of Christ from the throne of the Father in heaven. So a translation of that is when you interpret this covenant literally, it's not happening now. It's never happened in history. It's yet future. And the only place in history where it could be fulfilled is in the millennial kingdom. We've also seen that these promises are unconditional. We walked through the reasons for their unconditionality. We also saw that these covenantal promises are unfulfilled. They have never been fulfilled in the days of Joshua. In fact, the Joshua generation only got a small fraction of everything that was promised. In fact, the Joshua generation didn't even capture Jerusalem. Jerusalem didn't become a Jewish city until whose time period? David's, 400 years later. Beyond that, this covenant is forever. How could it be fulfilled in the days of Joshua or Solomon, for that matter, when the nation was evicted from the land after the days of Solomon and Joshua? So the dimensions of the land have never been fulfilled. The forever promise has never been fulfilled. Amos 9 comes along in 755 BC, long after the time of both Joshua and Solomon, and he reaffirms those promises. And you'll find that in Amos 9, 11 through 15. Why reaffirm promises if they've been fulfilled in the past? It doesn't make any sense. So So the conclusion is that this covenant structure is necessary, covenantal. It gives specific promises of land, seed, and blessing. It's reliable. It's the basis of the sub-covenants. It's unconditional, and it's unfulfilled. And if you believe that, and everything I've said, your whole eschatology is now in place. Because God cannot lie, He must move His hand in history to fulfill what He said. That's why I had you turn, if you will, to Exodus 2 and verse 24. Why did the Exodus happen? The Exodus is one of the greatest redemptive events in the history of mankind. Why did that happen? Because God felt sorry for His people? Maybe that was part of it. But notice Exodus 2:24. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered His what? His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Exodus event happened because God was fulfilling what He said He would do in the covenant, the unconditional covenant in which He cannot lie. And that's essentially why the end time program has to take place. Notice, if you will, Ezekiel 36. And notice verse 22. This is the famous passage of Israel being regathered from the nations in the last days. First, she's brought back into the land in unbelief, and then she's regenerated in fulfillment of the land covenant and the Davidic covenant and the new covenant. But why is God doing it? Notice, if you will, Ezekiel 36 and verse 22. Therefore, say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, it is not for your sake, O Israel, that I am about to act, but for my holy name, which you have profaned among the nations where you went. God says, I'm going to do this thing not because of you, not because of some merit in you, my chosen people, the nation of Israel. In fact, you're the ones that have profaned my name throughout the earth. I'm about to act not for your sake, but to vindicate my holiness. So, if God promised something but never made good on the promise, He would have egg on His face, in a sense. He would look bad. And He is not about to allow that to happen. His very character and His very nature demand, at some point in time, He make good on these promises. This is why the Exodus happened. This is also why the end time regathering of Israel has to happen. And it's also why the kingdom must transpire. So that's what our camp says. But as many of you have acknowledged to me, you're not hearing this kind of thing from most of your churches. You're not hearing this kind of thing from most of your seminaries and Bible colleges. And so the other side of the argument, the amillennial argument, the replacement theologians' argument, they must have some response to what we have said. And I'm going to give you their seven arguments that they use. I'm going to throw in an eighth at the end. Because you'll notice that ever since the time of Augustine, they say the same thing over and over and over again. As Solomon said, there's nothing what new under the sun. So let's go through their traditional arguments so that we can get comfortable with them in advance. And we'll be ready to have a dialogue with pastors, interested lay people, relatives, friends that may have a different theological persuasion.